One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Sarah and I have talked many times about our desire to age as gracefully as possible, and skincare is a huge piece of that. I spend a lot of time and money thinking about my skin, and I have added Ritual to my routine, which just gives me a lot of comfort. Ritual is here for us. They have created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted clinical studies, so we know it's working. They're taking the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual Hyacera is one of several Ritual products that I love. I take the daily multivitamin, I take a probiotic, and Hyacera is that once daily skincare supplement that is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. I recently met a friend for the first time in person as opposed to online, and we were discussing the fact that I'm 43, and she said, "I cannot believe how young you look." And I thought, thank you, Ritual, for that. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Pantsuit Politics. I am so excited to be joined today by Dr. Tamara Tweel, and she is going to tell you her official title because it's very fancy and very long.
I don't know about that. It definitely is long. I'm currently the Director of Strategic Development at Hillel International's Office of Innovation, which is a think and do tank for the Hillel movement and the Jewish people.
That's wonderful. That sounds really, really cool.
Yeah, I feel really blessed to be there. I'm enjoying it. I also get to still teach, which I love.
Now, and tell us a little bit about your background.
In what way?
Like your career education background. Or I guess you can also tell us how you ended up before the Ohio legislator testifying.
Oh my gosh, okay. Professionally, I guess I graduated college as a political science and art history major. And then
I was an art history minor, but that's amazing.
I felt like we had that in common hearing you speak. I really appreciate your sensibility. I feel like we are fellow travelers in that way.
I love it.
So, yeah, and then I went to divinity school and I got a master's in theological studies. And then worked in New York City at the Interfaith Center of New York, and then went back to get my PhD in U.S. history at Columbia. And I ended up in Ohio because I was teaching at, my husband was there for work, and then I ended up at a fellowship at Ohio State. So we were there for 5 years, which is how I ended up, that's a short story of how I ended up there and in front of the legislature.
So I first encountered your story because a shared friend sent it to me, but it was, you know, actually, I don't know if Laura sent the story to me first or if I saw it in Lenny Letter, but then I started reading about your experience and it really touched me because and I don't know if Laura shared this with you, our mutual friend, but that I also lost a pregnancy at about 16 weeks it was 20 weeks, but the fetus had passed away at 16 weeks.
And I'm so sorry.
Oh, well, thank you. And I had a doctor at the time who was the only option that was presented to me was labor. And I was like, I always described it as a horse on a bit. Like, I was like, nope, not going to happen. I'm not doing that. And Laura, through her support, who was also just like, you're not going to do that. That's not going to happen. And she was like, I don't know what you're going to do, but that's not it. And so I started calling a mutual friend of mine, and I was very lucky, and I found a doctor in my town who performed D&Es as late as I was, basically. I was very close to the cutoff, but it was fine, and I was able to have surgery, which was much less traumatic for me than going through labor. And so I have this very personal connection to the idea that women, when facing truly terrible situations, should not be additionally traumatized by our medical system, which is unfortunately what seemed to happen to you.
Yeah, and I just, and I'm sure you were in the same stage of life that I was, which is, you know, it took me a while to get pregnant. My first pregnancy, you can sort of tell that from the article, but my first pregnancy, I also had to have a DNC at 13 weeks. And then my second pregnancy, thank God, was viable, and I had a beautiful child. And then this was my third pregnancy. So I've always felt like this stage of my life was not about each individual pregnancy, but that I had a life-giving capacity, and I wanted to preserve it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the hardship for me, if I had to go through the like awful process of going into labor for a non-viable pregnant fetus, that like, you're just taking away even more of the time in which you could have a child, mm-hmm. and you're adding more and more risk. And it was actually going to hurt my capacity to be life-giving.
So tell us about what happened, if you don't mind.
So it was, as I had mentioned, it was my third pregnancy. It was a very wanted pregnancy. I was really, really thrilled to be pregnant. And at my 13-week sonogram, the nurse looked scared. The doctor came in. Mm-hmm. Nothing about the fetus looked, it just looked really bad according to the sonogram specialist and my doctor. So like the details are unfortunately just really sad. Like the organs weren't in the baby's body. The feet were turned in the wrong way. And my doctor, I wasn't my doctor, but the doctor who was seeing me at the time, told me that the fetus was not compatible with life. Like that was the language. So I went home, and then that was, it's actually really interesting to me because my doctor wanted me to have the DNC immediately. Because he had also gone through this process with me and like very much knew that I wanted to be pregnant, and knew that giving birth to a stillborn would put me at risk. Mm-hmm. And then I learned from like other doctors later that it wasn't just like a risk for my fertility, but like a real risk to my life. Mm. Like where there were all these things that could go wrong that would be like life threatening.
Oh, wow.
And I think I had mentioned in the Lenny letter that like right after my ordeal, and I'll tell you more about it, there was a woman in Ireland who actually died from a very similar diagnosis.
I did. I read her story.
Yeah. So it was a remarkably similar situation, and that woman simply needed a DNC. She was never going to have a viable pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And it was like agreed. So at this stage, I would say it was agreed that the fetus would never live. And I'm a religious person, so I also didn't understand. In my first pregnancy, there was no heartbeat. So I knew that when I had the DNC, everyone was sort of on board. But in this pregnancy, there was a heartbeat. So everything became much more complicated, mm-hmm. because of where I lived in Ohio. Mm-hmm. So the immediate complication was the insurance company wouldn't cover it. And so my doctors wanted to send me to Planned Parenthood. And then this whole thing just became really like explosive because everyone was calling it an abortion. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want an abortion. I just didn't understand the language here.
Yeah.
And finally, it just felt so crass. It just felt very crass. Mm. So what I did also was I actually called my rabbi, because as these things came up, I just was so confused. I wasn't sure, I wasn't sure how I should define life. Mm-hmm. So I spoke with my rabbi, who had very clear instructions for me, but was also tentative, and then called his rabbis. So I kind of had like a group. Well, you know, when you get to these issues, you want to have as much input. But I had like a really wonderful relationship with my rabbi, and he had wonderful relationships. And they all came to the conclusion that I should have the DNC immediately. Mm. And I talk about this in the article, but the way it was explained to me, and I'm not a rabbi, but that Jewish law really does see a continuum between potential life and actual life. But to understand something as actual life, it does have to be able to breathe outside of the womb.
Mm.
And there is a real emphasis placed on viability. So the fact that my fetus was non-viable meant for my religious leaders that I should have the DNC immediately, and I should not consider it a life. Like, you don't, it's not a life according to mm-hmm. what they told me. And then that got me interested in all these things, because I realized when I just started reading about it with my rabbi that so many of the metaphors were different. Like, the biblical metaphors for life were really centered on breath. Mm. And the rise of the heartbeat as a metaphor seems much more recent.
Yeah.
And doesn't seem to have this, like, deep religious connection. So that all happened. And then, thank God, I, like, eventually the insurance company covered it. Eventually I was able to have the DNC. Although before I had it, I was still everybody treated me as if I were having an optional abortion.
Mm.
So I had to go in like 24 hours in advance. I had to read the pamphlet on abortion.
Mm.
And it was all, you know, I mean, you've been there. Like, when you want the baby, it's so devastating anyway. And then to be treated as if I were like, the whole thing felt like really, really cruel.
Yeah.
And not just cruel to me, but cruel to the nursing staff and cruel to the doctors. Like, they don't want to do that. They just wanted to be able to care for me.
Right.
Like, to watch my doctor had to make me sign letter of consent, and she had to watch me do it. And then the whole thing felt so invasive and so not about my personal situation and health.
Right. Right. And that's, you know, the continuum part to me is something I think that, you know, is something I've thought a lot about since then. And I think what is, what nobody sort of wants to say or talk about is that we don't really treat life all the same, even once you can breathe, you know, like, and once a child is viable. Like, I've sort of reached this sort of place where I think, you know what, we want to act like we value all life equally, but we really don't. And what I started thinking about a lot is experiencing the loss I did where I did. I started to realize how differently, you know, when you've never experienced anything like that, I feel like it's just so foreign. And sort of once you place yourself in that spectrum, then you start to, there's like a sort of inescapable comparison and thought experiment that I went through, which was, you know, what happened to me was very sad and it was a loss. Would I compare it to somebody who carried a child for 9 months and then there and had a stillbirth? No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't even begin to compare my loss and their grief, or to somebody who had a 3-month-old die of SIDS, or somebody. And now, and my instinct is that not many people would. Not many people would have a stillborn child and then look at a mother who lost a 6-month-old or a 6-year-old and say it's the same. So why do we try to put everything in this formula so that we can, you know, draw this hard line, and instead of saying this is complicated and it's a spectrum and it's difficult? And, you know, I think that that is so powerful that your religious leader said, no, it's a spectrum. And why don't we just all acknowledge that it's a difficult, complicated spectrum?
And I also felt personally, and it's a way that I've tried to think about it a lot, is there are deep values guiding like religious legal decisions.
Mm.
And like in those, you know, one of the major values is this incredible like respect and awe for life and like human beings' capacity to create life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that everyone holds that very dear. But then how do you apply that in an ethical way to all these different contexts?
Right.
And that's where I feel like you're 100% right. Like, the questions of continuum come in. I mean, everything should come in.
Yeah.
Like, and I think the problem with, or one of the hardships I find with the way the conversation takes place is it's always in the abstract.
Yeah.
And it's always as if there's one value, there's like a single value, mm-hmm. and we don't know how to discuss like moral complexity or how that value is applied.
Well, and I don't, you know, and I think the sort of the experience itself has opened up a way for me to sort of have those conversations. I had a friend, a dear friend who I was talking with, and I said, you know, she felt she is Catholic and devout and pro-life, and her personal experience had been friends in graduate school who she felt were dismissively having abortions. And I said, I understand your moral and ethical concerns with their decision making. And if you can figure out a way to address those without sweeping up people like you, you know, or the women in, you know, my friends in North Carolina who have to lecture women who want babies about adoption because their babies aren't viable, then I'm all ears. Really, I am. I would love to have those. If you can figure out a fair, objective way to sweep in this continuum without, like you said, making the process so cruel to certain populations, then I would love to hear it. But if you're going to make it difficult for somebody, you're going to make it difficult for everybody.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. And I also would just love to, and I feel like you and your colleague did this so beautifully, like, what does it look like to really respect women going through this mm-hmm. and assume that they are moral, ethical human beings first? Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that really bothered me, is I felt like the state had made all these assumptions about my character.
Yep.
And my personal relationship with my God and my religious leaders. Like, they didn't assume the best of me. Mm-hmm. And I find that happens all the time. Like, I would love every woman to treat another woman as if they live, like, ethical, moral lives.
It's so applicable among many issues. Like, I was listening to a really great podcast on poverty, and they said, you know, there's this assumption in our laws and the way we talk about poverty and social safety nets that the poor don't love their children as much as you do. But they do.
Yeah.
We make these assumptions, and it's so harmful. And with, you know, with regards to exactly what you said, I don't know if you have seen the documentary After Tiller.
No, I haven't.
I'm a person that likes to dive deeply into issues that affect me on a deeply personal level. It is not for everybody, but it's a documentary about late-term abortionists that remain after Dr. Tiller was gunned down in his church several years ago.
Oh,
there's
wow.
only like four or five of them left around the country. And the way they speak, especially the two female doctors, about the ethical and moral questions surrounding late-term abortion is just so incredible. And the one line I never, ever stop thinking about is one of the female doctors says, you know, look, I cannot decide who gets this procedure based on what kind of how good their story is, because some people are better storytellers, and that should not determine the care they get. And
yeah,
I have to function under the assumption that every woman is an expert in her own life. That's my fundamental value, is that every woman is an expert on her whole life, in her own life, you know. And that is, it seems, when you talk about liberty and you talk about independence and human dignity, like, shouldn't that be the fundamental assumption, period, about all of us?
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And I wonder also, like, we have to be able to balance that with all of us also being able to talk to people. And I'm thinking a lot about what's happening right now politically, and the march today, and everything that's going on. And I want to be able to have a conversation that really honors the values behind a movement that cares about the sanctity of life.
Yeah.
I really do. I want to be able to have that conversation with them, but I want them to be able to also have that conversation with so many women that honors their dignity and their individual, exactly what you said, their capacity to be like correct moral actors in their own life story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like you're trying to do that on your show, and I admire that so much, but I feel like we have to go both ways.
Yes.
To have a really effective conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so, you know, and sometimes I worry, like, is this a thing that is achievable on a sort of social, cultural, national level? Or, you know, my best friend is devoted Catholic. This is a different friend. I hang out with a lot of Catholics, it seems. But my best friend.
I love that you have. You're like the rare American who has a social circle.
I do.
That has deep political disagreements. We should all be so lucky.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, it's. I quote the Sister Wives. Just follow me. I swear I'm going somewhere. But I quote the Sister Wives a lot, the reality show, because one time they said, one of the Sister Wives was like, you know, this practice is religious for us. And the practice of polygamy is the idea that being in relationships with other women in the way that we are sort of rubs our rough edges off, right? And coming up against each other in disagreement, but continuing those relationships, it rubs our rough edges off. It forces all of us to look deeply at ourselves and, you know, examine our own beliefs. And I just, you know, I worry so much about the fact that, you know, so the echo chamber, and are we all going up against people that force us to rub our rough edges off? You know, like, that's important. And I don't know if, and with something as complicated as abortion, is that available beyond sort of personal relationships in which we disagree with each other? It seems like on some level it has to be, because it's an issue we are determined to legislate.
I know. I'm curious what you think about this. One thing I've been almost so surprised about is, I'm a teacher, really, by nature, and my favorite moment in a classroom is when everyone in the classroom realizes that now is the time where they get to have a values conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not just a policy conversation.
Yes.
But, like, and it's this rare, beautiful moment. Like, we're not just going to talk about the New Deal or the welfare state. We're going to jump back a minute and talk about, all right, what are our obligations to one another? Right. How do you structure obligation? And I feel like that has, I don't know why that's so hard to do on a national scale.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it seems like such a missing link. Like, we're always talking at the level of policy, but not honestly, because we haven't had the values conversation.
We are special breakfast people here at Pantsu Politics, but not just when Beth and I are on the road. The truth is, I want something warm from the oven every Saturday morning and Sunday morning. It's just the truth. It makes it feel special, makes it feel exciting. I don't want to work at it. So the first time I ever saw Wild Grain, which is bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, fresh pastas, and artisanal pastries, I was obsessed. You guys, I've been a member for over a year. It's amazing. It's so easy. Every item bakes from frozen in 25 minutes or less, no thawing required. You can fully customize your Wild Grain box. You can choose any combination of breads, pastas, pastries. You can even build a box of only breads, only pastas, or only pastries if you'd like. And for a limited time, you can get $30 off the first box, plus free croissants in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/pantsuit to start your subscription. Sometimes I make one single croissant just for me because I want to feel special, and they're so good. You heard me. Free croissants in every box, and $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/pantsuit. That's wildgrain.com/pantsuit, or you can use promo code pantsuit at checkout. Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. You guys, I love my Aura frames. I have one in my office. I have one in my kitchen. I have given one as a housewarming gift. I have given one as Mother's Day, Father's Day. They are the most amazing gifts because this app is a game changer, in my personal opinion, in digital frames. It makes it so, so easy to get the pictures on there and even videos. It plays like you're in Harry Potter, you guys. It is the best. I love mine so much. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Can I get something off my chest? Every day I feel a little pang of sadness because I think about Griffin going away to college. Y'all, he's a freshman in high school. This is not healthy or normal. This is why I have it on my list of things to talk to my therapist about. We all carry around these things, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us. Therapy is a safe space to get these things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge. You gotta get it off your chest. And you can get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/pantsuit.
I'm reading a really great book right now called Clash, and it's about like multiculturalism. And it's really interesting. They sort of frame all these different cultural clashes, be it race, Eastern, Western philosophies, gender, through the lens of interdependence versus independence. But one of my favorite points they make about culture is that the problem with having those conversations about our cultural values is that you have so many people that refuse to acknowledge the influence on culture, right? So they just...
Oh, that's interesting.
You know what I mean? Like, the problem is you have so many people that are like, well, it doesn't matter. I mean, everybody just does the right thing, and I'm just doing the right thing. I'm not influenced by any of this. So you can't really broach this, okay, let's talk about these bigger forces that weigh on all of us and that push us in different directions, because you have so many people that refuse to acknowledge that to begin with. And I think that is... I mean, I've never lived in another country, and I don't know how much that's at play, but it does seem like a distinctly American thing that we are independent and that nothing influences us, and that, you know, we are all our own independent thinkers.
Yeah, but even that, like, I would love to be in a room where everyone agrees, okay, like, let's say it's just a room where people are, I mean, I'd love to do this in a variety of settings, but if we just assume for a second that everyone believes in the sanctity of life, or everyone in the room just agrees in this value that, like, there is something divine in every human being, mm-hmm. right? Like a simple religious value that most people would agree on if they come out of a faith-based community. What do you do next? Like, then how do you prioritize that? Would it always go to pro-life, or if you really thought about it, would it become like a whole slew of issues that you'd want to take on?
Yeah.
And then how would you balance those priorities against? I mean, I loved in your podcast, I think, I can't remember if it was you or your colleague talked about her trying to balance the sanctity of life argument with an argument about a non-invasive government
mm-hmm.
or small government. Mm-hmm. And that made her not want to legislate abortion.
Yeah, like the liberty, but the liberty, like, aspect.
Yeah. And I was like, I would just love to be in a room where I could have that conversation with people, because I'm not sure it would end up the way it started.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's... And I think what's always bothered, you know, a lot of people from who engage, who feel like the sanctity of life is important, but struggle to engage with people who say that's their only value, is the sort of inconsistencies once the life has arrived, right? That's what everybody feels a lot of people feel so frustrated with. Because, and again, you know, I think that it was an interesting moment when basically Hillary Clinton during the campaign said a fetus does not have rights. Like, we have to start from there. And that is such a difficult argument. I understand wholeheartedly the legal argument she is making, but it's such a and I think that's the problem too, right? We have all these different conversations. We have cultural and religious and values, and then we have to take all that big pot of stuff and pour it in a mold, a legislative mold, which is so difficult. It's so incredibly difficult.
It is, and I also think it might be useful to start thinking about, okay, how do we define life? And that's one conversation. How do we define personhood? That's another conversation. And then how do we define citizen?
That's so true. Those are three different things.
They come with a different set of obligations.
Yeah, right.
And I felt like what she was talking about with rights was really the rights of personhood and or citizenship.
Yeah. Well, because if you want to say that a fetus has rights, then you can't really escape that they're bumping up against the woman carrying the fetus's rights. You got some overlapping rights, and that's really what law school's all about. Like, we got some bubbles bumping into each other, so what do we do? But if you can define those different levels, that's an interesting way to sort of think about it. And I think, you know, what I struggle with in my own personal experience. And I'd love to hear more about your actual experience testifying, and if you felt like the it got through to anybody. Is that people, you know, just, they don't, it's like they either, I feel like there's just sort of this shut off. Like when I had that conversation with my friend and I said, if you can figure out a way to affect, to not affect women who, you know, like you said, like that, to just, it feels cruel. It feels cruel to a certain group. Can you figure out how to stop that? And she was basically like, well, that's for people smarter than me. And I'm like, what? No. We don't get to just absolve ourselves of the difficulties. I mean, like, have you walked through a state legislator? They're not really up for these complex philosophical challenges, a lot of them. And so it's just like,
I also,
go ahead.
Oh, no, I also feel like when it comes to this issue, there's a, and this happens all the time, like, because life seems like so obviously a clear moral value to hold, you just get, there's a moment of self-satisfaction.
Yes.
Like, I'm arguing for this really clear moral place. Of course I'm right. How could there be nuance?
Yeah.
But then you dig into context, and it's like, there's just tons of nuance, yeah. And moral clarity is not a fair, maybe it's not moral clarity, but moral simplicity just isn't a fair approach.
That is so true. And that's why the closest I've ever gotten to sort of feeling like, I'm one of my friends I went to college with, and we argued about this stuff all the time, and we've sort of re-engaged over Facebook, but he's changed and I've changed and we've both grown more nuanced. And I said, like, don't we need to acknowledge that it's not as simple as we just value life, and we do value life differently, because you have two children, and you wouldn't, he said, you know, and yeah, I said, you wouldn't say to a woman who, you know, lost a six-year-old that's the same as somebody that had an abortion. And he's like, you know what, I wouldn't have said this in college, but you're right. He's like, we lost a twin pregnancy very early, and it was very sad, but now I have, you know, these 1-year-old babies, and I would never, if something happened to them, it would not be the same. And like, it's just, but we want the simplicity of life is life and it should be valued at all thing, but we don't even want to acknowledge that it's not that simple, and that none of us really go through our daily actions acting like that.
Yeah,
but it's so hard. It's such a hard thing to acknowledge and think about. And well, what does it mean if we really don't treat or behave as if all life is equally valuable? You know, that's a really, really hard thing to think about. And it's a hard thing to say out loud. You feel sort of like a monster. But
I don't know if I would put it that way. I would say that even for someone who is really strictly pro-life, I think they could say that all life is valuable, but there is a distinction between potential life and personhood, mm-hmm. or life and person. Like, I think they could find language that doesn't feel crass to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, for your friend, like, I feel like he maybe would come to the conclusion that he wants to call, like, what I would say is potential life, he wants to call actual life. And he still might want to make a distinction between that and personhood.
Well, and you know what my friend said one day, this is back to the other friend, my best friend. She said, you know, the truth is a fetus is alive in the same way your liver or your kidney is alive. It has live tissue. Yeah. It is alive. That doesn't mean it is a life, depending on your definition, but it is most certainly alive. And I thought that it was an interesting distinction that I'd never, like, it's such a simple, I mean, you're talking about one letter and a space, and it changes the whole conversation.
Totally.
But I do, you know, and to like, be forthright and, you know, fully nuanced here, I don't think that the pro-choice movement acknowledges the difficulties and the the hard distinctions within these discussions as well. And I understand the instinct. I mean, and both sides do it. I'm just going to go to the end and double down in the hope that I won't lose any ground because I've staked out this ideological hard position. And it doesn't get either of us anywhere, I don't feel like.
No, I totally agree. I also can't, I really have a cat. I don't like that language. That language feels thin or shallow to me. Like, I have so many friends who've gone through abortions, and I don't think any of them felt like it was a choice or an easy choice. Or like, the idea of being pro-choice as a choice is like a word that comes to your mind when you're going through this, like, completely overwhelming, challenging experience just has always felt really wrong to me.
Yeah, no, I totally
agree. And doesn't acknowledge the moral gravity that everybody feels.
Yeah.
And I think it lets both sides not take on the other side's moral gravity.
Right. Absolutely. So I do want to hear more about your actual experience of testifying.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. I did it twice, actually. So I testified twice. And I had, first of all, I would say I was really honored to be a part of the group of people that testified. Like, it was a really powerful experience. There were doctors, priests, Planned Parenthood representatives, and I felt like all of them came from a place of real nuance. Like, I didn't see anyone. I mean, you would have just been so touched by how everyone spoke.
That's awesome.
Like, it was really, really touching. My experience testifying, I would say, was really mixed. The positive experience was I felt like I don't think most people on the committees that I testified to thought there was a religious argument against the heartbeat, though. Like, for them, I really don't think they'd considered that not all religions think of the heartbeat as the most important marker for life.
Right.
Or that the idea of a heartbeat was really just a metaphor for life, and we were listing one metaphor above all others, like breath or brain activity or, you know, all the medical ethics debates you could have.
Right.
And a lot of the questions I got were really about that. And those questions, I would say, were really sensitive and thoughtful. And I actually felt like the majority of people on the committee did not respect what I had to go through. Like, they thought that was wrong. They would have preferred that I was just able to get a DNC and continue on this process of trying to create life. Saying that, our side lost at both committee hearings, the heartbeat bill. And I think what happened and what I realized was happening is that it was a sacrifice. People like me and my case were sacrifices they were willing to make.
Oh, that makes me so furious. I would be shocked. I don't know how my headphones aren't melting because there's fire coming out of my ears. Like, but you know what? I appreciate you articulating that and, like, let's be honest with ourselves about that. That's what's happening.
Yeah, I really felt like that's what was happening. It was just, that was a sacrifice worth making to get what they feel, I guess. And the heartbeat bill, especially, it's so hard for me to wrap my head around what they're really thinking.
And because
exceptions that come up are crazy.
Sarah and I have talked many times about our desire to age as gracefully as possible, and skincare is a huge piece of that. I spend a lot of time and money thinking about my skin, and I have added Ritual to my routine, which just gives me a lot of comfort. Ritual is here for us. They have created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted clinical studies, so we know it's working. They're taking the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual Hyacera is one of several Ritual products that I love. I take the daily multivitamin, I take a probiotic, and Hyacera is that once daily skincare supplement that is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. I recently met a friend for the first time in person as opposed to online, and we were discussing the fact that I'm 43, and she said, "I cannot believe how young you look." And I thought, thank you, Ritual, for that. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they make solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval.
comfort, and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a double A cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. And they've even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit right. It's time to get your problems solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
There's not much worse than a dry and itchy scalp. Also, when you get your hair colored and then it does not last as long as you and your stylist discussed, it could be that unfiltered, mineral-filled water is the culprit. Hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin, and about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered shower head comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered shower head. Dermatologists recommended this unique three-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered shower head is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze, and its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered showerhead purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
It reminds me of a similar sanctity of life situation, which is the death penalty. And what I always tell people is, I'm opposed to the death penalty because we execute and will continue to execute innocent people. If you are willing to execute innocent people to get the worst of the worst, then that is an argument you can make, but be honest with yourself. And so maybe this is what we're sort of facing in this situation. If you're willing to sacrifice and be cruel to women like us, then let's just be honest with it. Let's put all our cards on the table and be clear about what's happening.
Yeah, and one thing I remember having this conversation, which was, and I think I wrote this exact phrase, but I really believe it, which is like, life is not instantaneous. Like the idea that it's just like all of us hold within us, like the potential for more than one life, God willing, you know?
Right.
And I didn't like that they didn't care about my capacity to create life. They just cared about this one. Do you know what I mean? It just felt like such a denial of like who I am as like a woman and a mother and like on top of a patient. Like,
And it's just like, and it's an elevation. If you believe that fetal rights are a thing, then it's that legal thing. It's the elevation of those rights above everything else, of my right to be treated fairly, of my right to pursue future fertility, it's the liberty of almost just to be in control of your own time, of your own, you're legally mandating, like you said, that I lose. And any woman who's ever tried to get pregnant understands how long a month can be. You know, and if you're mandating that I stay in this medical condition, and let's just assume there's no risk, which is never the case. Then you're mandating that you're robbing me of the liberty of controlling my own time and months and years of my life. Like, it's crazy.
This is so crazy. And for something that isn't alive.
Yeah.
Like, my fetus had no medical person I spoke to thought this was a viable fetus. There was no operation that could happen. There wasn't any intervention in modern science that could have made this fetus survive outside the womb.
Well, and it's like, to me, even if you're in a situation in which you think as a person that maybe, you know, let's assume that it is a situation in which you have conflicting opinions from medical professionals. How do you want this to work? Do you want like a panel in which the panel says, no woman who wants this child, you have to follow our recommendation about which medical opinion, and you have to pray for a miracle, and you have to go through these surgeries? You don't get a say? Because it feels like a little bit that's what's happening.
Totally. And I also felt like if you're a religious person, you have to respect other people's like faith.
Yeah. Yep. Or absence of faith. That is also.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
A belief system in that deserves to be protected. Yeah. It's just, and we had, Yeah. It's just so that this aspect of it was why I was so anxious too. And you know, it's a deeply personal issue for me because very easily what could have been wrong with my baby could have been something that exactly like yours. There was a heartbeat, but something else. Like I think about that all the time. I think about how traumatic and how hard it was. You know, I felt pressure and shame by merely choosing surgery because I still felt that. I talked to a woman who was, you know, kind and caring and was really just trying to emotionally support me. But she said at one point, you know, I just felt like my baby deserved a labor and delivery. And I thought, well, what does my baby deserve?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, no. My baby doesn't deserve anything at this point. You know, a baby I very much wanted. I had two children at this point. It's not like I did not understand or was not morally or ethically capable of comprehending what could have been or what was. But like the idea that this 16-week-old fetus had deserved something that would have clearly traumatized me. You know, like I can't time travel. I can't go back and have labor and delivery. But, you know, I feel being the expert in my own life, I chose not to deliver. I chose not to find out the sex of my baby. I chose to have the remains cremated. I made very specific choices because, you know, and my husband said it best. He said, there's enough to be sad about. Like, we don't need to find more things to be sad about. Like, I didn't name the baby. I didn't do any of these things. And so, and I, you know, being the expert in my own experience, feel for myself like it made my grieving process so much easy is not a good word to ever use in a sentence with grief, but you know, for me it felt right. And I think that, you know, I am still sad about what happened to me, but you know, I was a friend ended up losing a pregnancy at the same exact time I did, and I said, well, the one thing I can tell you is I know exactly how you feel. And we kind of talked about it. And I said, you're going to do the math until your due date passes. But then I told her, I'm like, but let me tell you this. I can't even do the math in my head quickly enough. I said, like, you know, 3 years later, the due date passed. And I didn't even notice until Facebook reminded me. You know what I mean? Like, it's not something that weighs on me all the time. It's sad. And I don't not think about it. But I don't feel stuck in a grieving process that I worry I might have had I gone through a different experience.
Yeah, and I'm sure you see this too. Like, I feel like all of my friends have gone through something.
Yes.
Like that.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Like I think the stats are like 80%. There's really high statistics on women. Like, once you want to, so the idea of legislating around this issue. When if like it's 80, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but the last I heard it was around 80% of women who want to have children end up with a miscarriage along the way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think like, about I my personal church group of friends. Like, there's like about 10 young families. Every single woman in that group has either had a miscarriage, a pregnancy loss, or a stillborn. Everyone, all 10 of us.
Like, this might be what it is to create life. Like, this might be what it's a process. Like, it's an actual process, and you're not every pregnancy is going to result in, like, I wish it would, but, like, the medical community needs to be able to help us.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like it's so dangerous for anyone to start legislating along these lines.
Well, and if I was feeling deeply philosophical, as I sometimes do, I would say, like, exactly what you said. You know, if the spiritual or religious value is that life is a spectrum, then what more do we need to see that than to see that once you decide to become a person who creates and gives life, that you experience, almost all of us will experience a spectrum. So
absolutely.
The experience of being a woman who, you know, decides to become a mother and give life means that you almost automatically are signing up for an experience that will be along those, that spectrum. And I think about all my friends and all the times we've, and all the people in my own experience who have faced the challenges of infertility or miscarriage and all these things. And I think, how much easier would it have been if from the beginning, the lesson we were taught was that this is a spectrum of experience, and that, you know, to understand that it is not this neat package that our culture sells us, that, and that, not just pregnancy, parenting itself, right? I was telling
myself. Totally. And even and I even feel like women who have abortions should feel that way.
Absolutely.
Like, this isn't the end of their fertility. This is like, you know, it is this complicated, long process, and we need to support each other throughout the entire. I love what you're saying. Like, this is a long continuum. Yep. It's going to hit us in ways we didn't expect, but we all have to understand ourselves and our, like, fellow human beings as part of this continuum and undergoing it if they're women.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a really great, I think it's the head of NARAL. Mm-hmm. She came to the Democratic National Convention and told her own personal story of how she'd had an abortion and now she has two children. And she said, I tell my story just to disavow the idea that bad girls have abortions and good girls have families. No, it's everybody is those girls at different points
powerful.
In their lives. Yeah, she was amazing. She was like, it was such a powerful speech. But, you know, we do this to ourselves and as women, the culture generally. I think this idea that everything is a neat package and the value is found in this package. And if you do not check off the boxes, it is not a valuable experience. It's like, it's so painful and unnecessary.
I know. And it hurts me so much that I see this, that like our morality almost becomes a weapon against each other. I can't stand it.
Yeah, and the experiences that we have no control over become a weapon against us.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, wow, I think that is an excellent place to end on.
Thank you to our sorority sister, Angie, and Laura for their awesome donations to Pantsuit Politics, and to Maria and Adela for becoming new subscribers. And as always, thank you to Melissa, Tracy, Ashley, Audrey, Christine, Nicolette, Paige, and Sydney for their all-star rockstar donations. We also wanted to ask everybody to check us out on the Dear Maddie Show. We had a fantastic conversation, and we really think you guys are going to enjoy it. So go check him out on iTunes or your podcast platform. And as always, keep it nuanced, y'all. Thank you to our producer, Nicholas Holland, and to our chief creative officer, Dante Lima, for all the work they do to make Pantsuit Politics possible. And to all of you for making this community so special. Remember to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Pantsuit Politics or Instagram at Pantsuit Politics. Please leave us your feedback and send us your ideas for show topics and pantsuit primers on social media, or you can email us at Sarah@pantsuitpoliticsshow.com or Beth@pantsuitpoliticsshow.com.